Let's begin by reading some words from First Book of Kings, chapter 8. First Book of Kings, chapter 8, and at verse 54. First Kings, chapter 8, verse 54, where we find Solomon at the dedication of the temple. And so it was when Solomon had finished praying all this prayer and supplication to the Lord, that he arose from before the altar of the Lord, from kneeling on his knees with his hands spread up to heaven. Then he stood and blessed all the assembly of the Lord with a loud voice, saying, "Blessed be the Lord, who has given rest to his people Israel, according to all that he promised. There has not failed one word of all his good promise, which he promised through his servant Moses. May the Lord our God be with us, as he was with our fathers. May he not leave us nor forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to himself, to walk in all his ways, and to keep his commandments and his statutes and his judgments, which he commanded to our fathers." Amen. May God bless the reading of his word. May the Lord our God be with us as he was with our fathers. One of the great sentiments of Solomon at this great historic time was that God would be with and bless his people just as he had done in the past. And we live in a country which God has blessed in the past. And we can echo this prayer of Solomon, that God would be with us as he was with our fathers. But to pray that intelligently, we need to understand and know and appreciate the heritage that God has given us as Christians in this land. And so I'm very thankful to Kevin for this invitation to come up and spend a day with you and to begin the day by opening up the life and some of the lessons we can learn from James Durham. If I was to give this a title, it would be James Durham, 1622 to 1658, framed in the 17th century, A Life Lived in Service of the Church. A Life Lived in Service of the Church. What we'll see as we run through Durham's life is that again and again he sacrifices his own desires to do what the Church of Jesus Christ calls him to do. My own history with James Durham goes back almost half my life ago. As an 18-year-old student, I bought one of his commentaries and have never really looked back since that day. James Durham has been a big influence on my life, so it's all the Banner of Truth's fault for republishing one of his commentaries. And in my late 20s, I spent 6 years doing a PhD on James Durham, particularly his teaching on the free offer of the gospel. And it was right at the start of my PhD studies on Durham that I first met Kevin in a classroom down in Wales when we were both doing a research methodology module. But if I have loved Durham, if this man James has been a great passion of my life, then I have to confess I've not always been very successful in stirring up that same passion and that same interest in other people. As a newly married man, Ruth and myself went off on honeymoon to Switzerland, as any good Reformed couple would do, Geneva, John Calvin and all that. Sunday morning, we go to a local church, but Sunday evening, there's really nothing on, so I'll introduce my new wife to James Durham, the excellence of his preaching. It's going to be good. So I'll read one of James Durham's sermons to Ruth. All starts off fantastically. Ruth's loving the sermon. But it's not a short sermon, so on it goes. still sort of going okay, but as we get towards the half hour mark, my audience is kind of asleep, and so lengthy sermons, and didn't go ever so well. Ruth was very kind. She let me spend 6 years studying this man that had put her to sleep at the beginning of our married life. But hopefully I'll be more successful this morning. Don't intend to put any of you to sleep, I hope, but we'll see how it goes. So I'd like to do four, potentially five things as we consider James Durham this morning. First, give some testimonials from other people about him, establish his credentials, as it were, because I guess if I asked for a show of hands as to how many have heard of James Durham before this weekend, it wouldn't be that many. And if I asked how many have read anything he's written, it would be even less. So we'll just spend a little bit of time giving some proof as to why it's worth getting to know this man. Then we'll situate him in the times in which he lived, very turbulent days in the 17th century. We'll give a summary of his life and his character. We'll highlight some of his key writings, most of which have been reprinted in the past 20 years. And then finally, we might have some time for some questions and discussion. We'll see how it goes. First then, how have other people spoken of this man, James Durham, 1622 to 1658? Samuel Rutherford, you may have heard of one of Durham's great Scottish contemporaries through his letters and his other influence. Well, Samuel Rutherford wrote to James Durham the letters in his book of letters as Durham lay dying. Rutherford wrote and said to Durham that you have preached well to others the skill of the guide, meaning that Durham had explained well to others how to get to heaven, and so that now he was on the verge of doing this, he could go with confidence. And Rutherford went on to lament Durham's death, saying it would be a real loss to the Church of God. Another Scotsman, Robert Bailey, another of the Scottish guys who went down to the Westminster Assembly to help write and shape the Westminster Confession, he said of James Durham, "I lived to the very last with him in great and uninterrupted love and in high estimation of his remarkable accomplishments, which made him precious to me among the most excellent divines I have been acquainted with in the whole isle." This man, Robert Bailey, knew all the great Puritan ministers. This is the flourishing period of the Puritans. And yet he said of James Durham that he's amongst the most excellent of all the people he had met. Profound theologian, great preacher, great Christian character. Durham was also loved not just in Scotland. He was loved in England as well. John Owen, perhaps the greatest of the English Puritan theologians, wrote two forewords to Durham's books. One of them, John Owen, spoke of the reputation which the known piety and abilities of its author have in the Church of God. And he said, "And this Durham has deservedly." John Owen said Durham had good learning, sound judgment, and was in every way a workman that does not need to be ashamed. So Durham was seen as a great figure in the 17th century, an age of the Church which abounded in profound theologians and great preachers. But Durham's influence also endured through the centuries after his life. There's a controversy in the Scottish Church in the early 1700s, the 18th century, called the Marrow Controversy. Well worth getting to know that. The Marrow men, great theologians Thomas Boston and others, referred to James Durham as a great theologian. He was one of the authorities they cited. In the 1700s, he was a man you would appeal to if you wanted to justify your theological stance. Even later, in the mid-1800s, again the Scottish churches were convulsed by controversies and debates. And still, on the floors of the General Assembly of the Free Church of Scotland, when it had about a third of all the Christians in the country, still James Durham in the 1860s was being appealed to as an absolute authority and testimony to what should be done. But one of my favourite testimonies comes from another 19th century Scottish theologian, Rabbi Duncan, taught Hebrew in New College in Edinburgh. And this man, John Duncan, called Rabbi Duncan because he was so great at Hebrew, was reading Durham's sermons one Sunday afternoon, Durham's sermons on Isaiah 53. And Duncan recounts that he paused and he reflected. And he said, "Reading this man has been like eating the flesh and drinking the blood of Jesus Christ." He was just moved and overwhelmed by how James Durham had pointed him to the Lord Jesus Christ in his preaching and in his written sermons. So Durham was influential in his own day, and that influence continued down through the centuries. Just one final word of testimony regarding James Durham. One of the great summaries of Scottish theology is James Walker's history called Theology and Theologians of Scotland. And James Walker summarises James Durham by saying, "No Scotsman of that age, the 17th century, was more profoundly venerated. Durham's thought, his searching and cumbrous intellect, remind you not seldom of John Owen." Now, I could go on and on and on and fill the rest of the time we have together just by reading out what other people have said about James Durham. He's unknown today, virtually, but in the past, he's been seen as one of the key pivotal figures of Presbyterian theology and history. So that's why we should study him, and I hope I've gone some way to convincing you that he's worth our time and attention. But we need now to situate Durham in the context, the times, and the life in which he lived. What was 17th century Scotland like? And to understand 17th century Scotland, we need to understand the Reformation and what had actually changed in Scotland since the 16th century. Scotland embraced the Reformed faith in 1560. I have to confess that is sadly after the Reformation was embraced down here in England. We did get there after you, but in our defence, we were a bit more thorough, did things a bit better. So we did catch up and get ahead, I think. So 1560, the Scottish Church severs, the Scottish nation severs ties with Rome and with the Catholic Church, adopts a Reformed confession of faith, the Scots Confession. And there's the first meeting of a general assembly, really, with Presbyterianism established from the outset. But really, from the glories of the Reformation, the Church in Scotland always had a pretty difficult time with whoever the ruling monarch was. For its early years, the Church had to cope with a Catholic monarch, Mary. And then when the later monarchs, James and Charles, they were always trying to push the Scottish Church into subjection to the state. They were trying to turn the Church in Scotland effectively into the model that there was in England, where the king was the supreme ruler on the Church. And that really grew in speed once James VI of Scotland acquired the small impoverished nation to the south of Scotland in 1603 and took the lesser title of James I of England. And that sort of went to his head, and he kept pushing for more and more Episcopalianism in the Scottish Church. And eventually this just got too much for the Church in Scotland to bear. Charles I is on the throne. He says the Scottish Church has got to use the English service book. Sounds an awful lot like a Catholic service book to Scottish ears. So the first time this new service book is used in the mid-1630s, there's a mini rebellion. A very famous woman by the name of Jenny Geddes hears this service book. She sat on a stool, she picks up her stool, she throws it at the minister who's reading out the English service book and says, "Villain, will you say mass in my hearing?" And this one act by this woman essentially puts in train what's called the Second Reformation in Scotland, where all the Episcopal, quasi-Catholic teachings that were being imposed on the church in Scotland are swept away. So by the 1640s, when James Durham begins to come to prominence, the church in Scotland has been through its reformation, its decline, and then its re-reformation, its second reformation. So it's a pretty heroic, pretty dramatic context that Durham comes into. The church is rebelling against the king, saying, "We don't accept your authority. We will run the church the way we think we should." So that's the context for Durham's life, a re-reformed church in Scotland. Durham himself is born 1622. He's born somewhere between Edinburgh and Aberdeen in Angus, up on the sort of east coast of Scotland. And he's born into a family who are actually pretty happy, pretty content with the way the king was running the church. Durham's family quite liked the Episcopalian additions to the church in Scotland. They quite liked kneeling to receive the Lord's Supper and all the other things that were coming into the church. So Durham grew up with influences which were not conducive to having strong Protestant convictions. But strangely, Durham ends up marrying a woman, Anna, who comes from a family who were profoundly committed to the Scottish Reformation, the Knoxian, John Knox way of doing things. And through his marriage to this woman, who was a sound Christian woman, Durham was wondrously converted. He was with their family one Sunday. They took him kicking and screaming, basically, to hear one of the great Presbyterian preachers, Ephraim Melville. And under the word of God, Durham was just profoundly converted, and his whole life was turned around. It's one of the great illustrations, I think, that God can draw a straight line with a crooked stick. What Durham's family did and what his wife's family did were wrong. Christians like Anna, his wife, were not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. But yet, in God's providence, this was the means of converting James Durham. And his life was transformed. He was a carefree, easygoing country gentleman. He was living the life of a country laird, enjoying his hunting and his fishing. But the minute he's converted, he becomes a changed man. One of the first things he does, as you do if you're a country laird who's fairly well off, is he builds an extension onto his house as a study, so he can have a place where he can pray, read God's word, read theological books in peace and quiet. And that's just a little picture of how his life was changed. One of the biographies says, "A new atmosphere now filled Powry House," the great house he had. "The young laird made no secret of his convictions, whether in public or private. He was zealous in personal devotion, conscientious in family worship, and interested himself keenly in the welfare of the church." And there was a lot going on in the church and in the nation at the time Durham was converted. We're now in the time of the Civil War, or the War of the Three Kingdoms. English Parliament and the King, Charles I, are at war, and Scotland comes riding to the rescue of the English Parliament, joining the beleaguered army and sorting out the military situation in favour of sound Protestantism. And Durham's involved in this conflict. He's a captain in the army. And as one day Durham is praying with his troops in the army, David Dixon, the professor of theology in Glasgow University, happens to overhear Durham leading his company in prayer. And so profoundly affected by this prayer is David Dixon that he stops and says to James Durham, in effect, "If you get through this battle and this war alive, you have to consecrate your life to the gospel ministry." That one prayer, overheard seemingly coincidentally by someone who's just passing by, in God's providence, was ordained to be the means of compelling James Durham into the gospel ministry. You know, God's providence is just amazing. It just happened. Durham was praying at that time. It just happened that the professor of theology was passing by. And yet we know that all that was ordained by God to call this man into the gospel ministry. So after Durham is delivered from the battle, he goes and studies theology in Glasgow University and is ordained in 1647. Very interesting year. It's the year the Scottish Church subscribed the Westminster Confession of Faith. So Durham is the first, really, of a crop of young ministers who come into the church that is committed to the Westminster Confession of Faith. And it's amazing, really, to see Durham's rise to prominence in the church. 18 months after he's ordained, 18 months, he's appointed to the most powerful committee of the General Assembly of the church, the Standing Committee for Public Affairs. 2.5 years after he's ordained as a minister, he's called to be Professor of Divinity in Glasgow University. And Durham desperately wanted to be Professor of Theology. He felt it fitted his gifts. He felt it was his calling from God. He felt it was where he could be most useful for the Church of Jesus Christ, training ministers in theology. And so just as he's been called to what he sees as his life's work, what his heart's desire is, the church says, actually, no. We want you to do something else. Catastrophe has occurred. In the Civil War, we've reached the stage where Charles I was beheaded. Oliver Cromwell is now in ascendancy. Cromwell is no fan of strong Presbyterian church government. He's viewed in Scotland as a traitor, the one who's betrayed all the covenant obligations to establish Presbyterianism. So the Scots say, actually, we quite like Charles II to be our king, rather than this chap Oliver Cromwell running the show. The church in Scotland knows that Charles II is really a pretty ungodly sort of man, and so they send James Durham to be his chaplain to instruct him in religious affairs. So Durham thinks he's entering his life's calling to prepare godly young men for the gospel ministry, to spend his days in theological study and writing. And he ends up in the middle of political shenanigans, having to deal with an ungodly king and all the sins that wrapped around that in the royal court. It says something of the character of James Durham that 4 ministers were asked to go and be with the king, and Durham is the only one who faithfully went and performed his duty and stood beside Charles II. Despite that meaning, he lost his dream vocation and calling in life. Durham's days with Charles were pretty unhappy. Charles seemed to have respected Durham. If ever Durham was away on holiday, he wanted him called back to be with him. But it was a pretty miserable time for Durham. He was involved in political intrigue, in church politics. And I think it's fair to say he was quite relieved from one respect when Charles II was finally dealt with by Cromwell marching up and defeating the Scottish army. That freed Durham up to return to life in parish ministry. He was called again to preach in Glasgow. He spent his final years preaching in the High Church in Glasgow, now Glasgow Cathedral, the big massive church building in the centre of Glasgow. Said of him, he preached 3 times a week. He lectured before sermons on Sunday. He visited the sick. He catechised from house to house. He met with his session weekly on matters of church discipline, attended presbytery and synod meetings, gave daily public lectures every 5th week, undertook daily catechizing before communion, and spent a considerable part of every day in private devotion, prayer, and study. His first wife died, sadly, but then Durham married again later during his time in Glasgow. But if Durham was able to settle into quiet pastoral life after his unhappy years having to deal with the monarch, the church scene in Scotland just became tragic and broke the heart of James Durham. Scotland really struggled with the question, what is God saying to us in all this? We had the dream of establishing Presbyterianism in all of Britain, Scotland, England and Ireland. We covenanted together to see national Presbyterian churches in the three kingdoms. And yet God has sent an English army up into Scotland. God has even defeated us in Scotland, and we can't operate an effective Presbyterian system of church government even in Scotland. In 10 years, we've gone from being so close to seeing our dream in all the three kingdoms, and now it's been taken away from us even in our own land. Our Scottish army has been defeated by Cromwell. We are, in effect, an occupied country. Why has God done this? Why has God done this? And one section of the Scottish Church, a section represented by Samuel Rutherford, said, it's because we've been ungodly. We have been unfaithful. God is judging us. We sent too big an army to fight the English. There were too many ungodly men in our army who weren't faithful to Presbyterianism and the ideals of the covenants. So God is judging us. Like Gideon, we should have gone with our 300. We would have triumphed over Cromwell, and our dream would still be intact. The army should have been smaller. Other men in Scotland, including Robert Bailey, who was also at the Westminster Assembly with Samuel Rutherford, said, no. We lost because we failed to make the due use of the means God had given us. We tried to pare down our army too much. We didn't make use of all the soldiers God had given us. We sidelined our best military tacticians because we didn't think they were pure enough. And therefore we lost because we didn't use the means God gave us. Our army needs to be bigger and smarter and more inclusive. So you have the church arguing over who should and shouldn't be in the army. And it gets so bad in the Scottish church that men like Samuel Rutherford and Robert Bailey, David Dixon and others, they can hardly even share, they can't share communion together. Rutherford refuses to administer communion in St. Andrews at a sermon where one of the other Scottish ministers who took a different view was present. And Durham is just stuck in the middle, absolutely grief-stricken over what is going on. He writes a book as he's dying. I think partly it's workload. He just threw himself too much into work. But also, here's a man with a broken heart. Here's a man who was ordained the year the Scottish Church adopted the Westminster Confession. And in his 10 years of ministry, he's seen that dream crumble before his very eyes. He's a grief-stricken man. And he wrote a book, A Dying Man's Testimony to the Church in Scotland, or A Treatise on Scandal. And he lamented the divisions in the Scottish Church. He lamented that the Church was dividing over issues that had nothing to do with doctrine or theology. And actually, out of it has come one of the most helpful books on Presbyterian ecclesiology that I can actually think of. And many of the divisions in Presbyterianism over the years would have been avoided if attention had been paid to that book. So that's Durham. It's an interesting life. It's a life where he sacrificed himself for the good of the church on many occasions. But what about him as a person? What's he like as a man? Well, he's a man of utmost composure and gravity. He is, if you wish, probably your stereotypical Scottish Presbyterianism. He's not a guy you would go with to have a laugh. He's just a serious man. There's a story that one evening he's in a house with William Guthrie, one of the other great Scottish 17th century Presbyterians. And it said, in this gentleman's house, William Guthrie and James Durham were together at dinner. Mr. Guthrie was exceedingly merry, and he made Mr. Durham smile. Big achievement. Yes, even laugh. That's so unusual, it gets recorded as a historical event. His pleasant, facetious conversation lit up the evening. And then it was the ordinary course of the family to pray after dinner. So immediately after their mirth, it was put upon Mr. Guthrie to pray. And as he was wont, he fell immediately to the greatest measure of seriousness and fervency, to the astonishment of all present. When he rose from prayer, Mr. Durham came to him and embraced him and said, "Oh, William, you are a happy man. If I had been so daft as you have been this evening, I could not have been serious nor in any frame for prayer for 2 days." So Durham was quite a serious kind of chap. And that's, you know, Christians come in all shapes and sizes. You know, we have stereotypes of what a Presbyterian minister looks like, and okay, James Durham might fit in that picture. But here's another minister he loved and respected from exactly the same time period, just having a raucous evening of laughter and joy and pleasure. You know, God uses all shapes and sizes of Christians to bring forward his work. Durham was a serious man, but he was a humble man, a humble man. There's another story. Andrew Gray is another great Presbyterian preacher in the 17th century. Him and Durham, their churches were side by side. And the story goes, Mr. Durham, with some of his elders, saw the people running away from him to hear Mr. Gray. The elders seemed to be very displeased. But Mr. Durham said, "Let them alone. Let them go where they think they will profit most. It is probable, if I was in their case, I would do exactly the same thing." So he was a humble man who wasn't concerned overly much that people were going to hear one of his great contemporaries. And in his humility, he said, "Well, actually, if I had the freedom, I'd probably go and hear him rather than myself." Now, that's not a true reflection on Durham's abilities as a preacher, but it's a good reflection on his character, I think. And sort of going on from that, Durham, I think, is the best theologian moving around in these circles in Scotland at his time. But he wasn't as blessed in his preaching as some of his contemporaries. You read Samuel Rutherford's sermons, and he just throws out illustration after illustration, wonderful picture after wonderful picture, and you're just carried along on this flow of imagery, and it's just wonderful. And then you read Durham's sermons, and the theology is just incredible. The exegesis is so helpful. But that's all there is. There aren't the illustrations and the word pictures to bring you on. It was said, Mr. Durham was like a great bottle full of excellent good wine. But when it went to come out, it could not well come out. So Mr. Durham had little expression, but much good and great matter. So even in his own day, it was seen that the content was like the finest of wines. But when you went to pour it out into the glass, it didn't necessarily flow so freely. And God doesn't give everyone every gift. That's why we have sort of collegiality in church leadership. No one is blessed in every way. And it's important that we recognise that and don't look to any one person to have everything. So, time is running on, but just very briefly, some of Durham's key contributions, key writings. You probably know this book, The Westminster Confession of Faith and Subordinate Standards. Durham didn't write the Westminster Confession, so why am I holding this up as one of his key contributions? Well, if you leaf through this, you'll eventually come to a section called The Sum of Saving Knowledge, a brief sum of Christian doctrine outlined in the foresaid Confession of Faith and Catechisms. The Sum of Saving Knowledge, bound with every printed edition now that you'll get of the Westminster Standards, and it was written by none other than James Durham in cooperation with one of his colleagues, David Dixon. They essentially reshaped some of David Dixon's sermons to be a commentary on the Westminster Confession of Faith. Very, very helpful. Very, very wonderful stuff. And actually, this little section of the Westminster Standards was used under God to convert Robert Murray McShane, one of the great 19th century Presbyterians in Scotland who saw great revival, and that the memoirs of McShane are very much worth reading. He was converted essentially through the little work of James Durham included in the Westminster Standards. Mentioned this one already. Dying Man's Testimony to the Church in Scotland, or A Treatise on Scandal. It's a book of essentially looking at divisions both between individual Christians and then at the church or denomination level. It's so very practical and helpful, even just when it talks about us Christians. How do we avoid falling out with one another? A wonderful, just one sentence, which is, it takes two to tango. And he says, basically, it takes two Christians to create an offence. It takes one Christian to do something that would give offence. And then it takes another thing for a Christian to behave in a way that receives offence. So he's just saying that, you know, there are various ways to avoid division and faults in a church. And one is to look at ourselves and actually, are we taking offence unwisely or unhelpfully? So it's a wonderful, wonderful book and very, very helpful on the balance between the unity and purity of the Church of Jesus Christ. Now, you can read this book and you have to remember the context. Durham is a Westminster Confession man. He's a man who's subscribed to it without any scruples. He's writing it in that context. If you don't have that in mind and you read it, you can think he was a sort of proto-ecumenical guy before it became popular to be down that line. That's not at all what he's arguing for, but he's just arguing for wisdom in how Christians who share the same doctrinal basis interact with one another. This was the first book of Durham that I read, Commentary on the Song of Solomon, reprinted by the Banner of Truth. Durham takes a view of the Song of Solomon that it is a relationship between Christ and his church that is being explained and expounded. He's got a very helpful sort of 50-60 page hermeneutical introduction which explains why he comes to that conclusion, and it's just so helpful on the nature of true Christianity, that is not just this intellectual thing, that is that heart burning within us, there is that love between Jesus Christ and his church and the love of the church for Jesus Christ. So I personally find it very, 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 very helpful. Ten Commandments. Very helpful summary of the law. Just an excellent, excellent, excellent book. And then finally, I'll just mention The Unsearchable Riches of Christ, which is a collection of his sermons, some of the most wonderful, heartwarming sermons that we can have. You can see there's a big clunking commentary on Revelation as well, which probably wouldn't attract too many readers today. And there's an equally big collection of sermons on Isaiah 53 that I didn't take up because I forgot. 72 sermons on Isaiah 53. Fills all that, and not a word of repetition amongst them. So that is James Durham and his writings. Much more could be said, questions could be posed. Very interesting understanding of the relationship between the gospel ministry and evangelism. He said, the great work of ministers of the gospel is to invite and to endeavour to bring the marriage between Christ and sinners to a close. He saw the great thrust of the gospel ministry is a soul-winning ministry, an evangelistic ministry. So many more things we could explore. Calling to the ministry was very interesting. Was quite unromantic. Do you have the gifts? Does the church recognize those gifts? Are you persuaded to exercise those gifts for the good of the church? He saw it as a much more church-led process than a subjective, I feel called and burdened in this way. But I wouldn't weary you with any more on James Donovan. So that's his life and some of his writings.